Today is Wednesday, July 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What's the impact of the reported Russian bounty program on American politics?
If we get some type of evidence that this is indeed something that was presented to the president, it just paints another narrative that the Democrats can use.
Plus, does Hong Kong's new security law mark the end of one country, two systems?
The new national security law is incredibly dangerous to freedom.
And the Philippines' largest broadcaster is told to stop again. We'll have those stories and more next. Democrats have called for U.S. President Donald Trump to consider imposing new economic sanctions on Russia if a reported Russian effort to pay the Taliban to kill U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan is confirmed. Democrat Representative Steny Hoyer criticized the White House.
The president called this a hoax publicly. Nothing in the briefing that we have just received led me to believe it is a hoax.
But after being briefed by the White House, Republican Senate Armed Services Chairman Jim Inhofe said he believed Trump wasn't aware of the program before the New York Times broke the story.
I know the press likes to think the president knew about this and didn't say anything. It was a cover-up. He didn't know about it, and I'm convinced of that.
Speaking to Reuters News via Zoom, Trump critic and former National Security Advisor John Bolton shared this observation.
The fact is the president doesn't much like being briefed. He thinks he knows what he needs to know. That's wrong. I mean, that's just wrong.
Craig Albert is a political science professor and national security expert at Augusta University in Georgia. I began our conversation about the process of vetting information for presidential briefings.
Generally, the way a threat analysis works is that for the president, it's included in what are called presidential daily briefings. These can range anywhere from, you know, 1 to 5 or 10 pages. You try to keep them as brief as possible, and they will include bullet points or small paragraphs on precisely the type of threats that are facing the United States on that day. What will be in the presidential daily briefing for threat assessment and analysis are a brief description of what's going on, how the intel was gathered, what the intelligence community says. If there are divergent opinions on the intelligence analysis presented, which intelligence agencies differ and why, whether it's verified, and they will include some type of what we call like a confidence interval. You know, we are 70% assured that this is what's going to happen, or 80% assured that this is going to happen, or they'll even say this is unverified, but that information itself will be presented in the presidential daily briefing.
So if we step back and take a look at as the story is unfolding with the allegations that Russian intelligence operations attempted to pay bounties on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, what kind of implication does it have for the United States operating in the world theater for its armed forces?
Well, it just goes to show that Russia is definitely engaging in what could be called like a blurred or gray war against the United States. It's seeking to fight some type of, you know, proxy battles against the United States. It's great power politics at its best. Russia is trying to challenge the United States. In the last national security strategy of the United States, President Trump outlined and stated that Russia is a revisionist power. And what that means is that Russia is trying to shift the power balance of the world. It's trying to bring the United States' power down in an effort to increase its own power. It wants to regain its status as the world power, or at least co-equal to the United States. And this is something Putin has been looking to do for quite some time now, probably a decade. And this explains the information warfare campaigns against the United States on social media, interfering in United States' election process, which Russia is still doing and engaged in right now for the 2020 presidential election. And it explains the funding or the potential funding of Taliban or Taliban-linked criminal gangs trying to take out U.S. service members overseas, as well as coalition members as well, with a bounty placed on all coalition members operating in Afghanistan.
Speaking of the 2020 election, how important could this issue come to be in light of the United States is still dealing with the pandemic and it has the world's leading number of cases there?
the Democrats are being able to create a damaging picture that President Trump doesn't seem to be as hard on Russia as he should be. And that's a weird position for the president to be under, because in the national security strategy that his administration outlined, he states that Russia is a rising great power threat to the United States. So if this comes out that the president was briefed, and it seems that there were some mention of it in a presidential daily briefing, whether it was verbally communicated or on paper communicated, we're not sure of yet. But if we get some type of evidence that this is indeed something that was presented to the president, it just paints another narrative that the Democrats can use, that President Trump is not as hard on Russia as he should be. And they'll be able to use that to message their narrative that perhaps he's too friendly to Russia, that he doesn't take a threat from Russia seriously.
Craig Albert is a political science professor at Augusta University. A Chinese official said that a recently enacted national security law for Hong Kong is a birthday gift for the territory as it marks its 23rd anniversary of its handover to China. China's parliament passed the legislation Tuesday, giving Beijing sweeping powers and setting the stage for radical changes to the global financial hub's way of life. U.S. National Security Council spokesman John Yoloit called the legislation a violation of the 1984 Sino-British Joint Declaration that set the terms of Hong Kong's return to Chinese control, and he says Beijing now treats Hong Kong as one country, one system. Hong Kong police used a water cannon Wednesday to disperse activists protesting against the new national security legislation. The law will punish crimes of secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces with up to life in prison, and officially set up mainland security agencies in Hong Kong for the first time with powers beyond city laws. Olivia Enos is a senior policy analyst for Asia with the Heritage Foundation in Washington. And I asked her, while she was sitting on a park bench, if this was the end of one country, two systems.
The new national security law is incredibly dangerous to freedom in Hong Kong. Beijing's decision to act in this way is definitely an attempt to undermine the one country, two systems. And I think that framework is effectively over. However, that doesn't mean that it's the end of all forms of freedom in Hong Kong. I think if there's anything that is most in threat, it is definitely political freedom inside of Hong Kong. But the U.S., when it comes to its response, may have some latitude in its ability to preserve economic freedom in Hong Kong and should continue to go to bat and fight for the average freedoms of Hong Kongers. I think that this represents yet another attempt by Beijing to undermine autonomy in Hong Kong, but freedom isn't going to be gone overnight. So the real question is, what can the U.S. do now to try and preserve the freedoms that are left? And I think that's the big question that Congress is trying to answer and will be seeking to answer in the next weeks and months ahead.
You speak of the freedoms in Hong Kong not going away overnight. In July 1st, protests in Hong Kong, there are reports of hundreds of people being arrested because they are protesting the passage of the national security law. You brought the notion of economic freedoms versus sometimes political freedom. So how do you rectify some going away and some being preserved?
Well, Steve, as you mentioned, last night there were protests and over 300 people were arrested. Nine are believed to be arrested under the new national security law. People obviously have reason to be afraid, and we have to watch, you know, very closely for that. But I think that the new national security law is sort of another notch in Beijing's bedpost, if you will, when it comes to undermining freedom in Hong Kong, because we've seen over the last several years just a steady state of erosion. So the examples I would give is, you know, at Beijing's behest, Carrie Lam and the Legislative Council last year introduced the extradition bill, which would have also posed a severe threat to freedom in Hong Kong, although arguably not so much as the, you know, national security law does now. But we also saw Beijing earlier on, and even, you know, after the 2019 protests, attempting to undermine freedom in Hong Kong's judiciary by intervening on Hong Kong judiciary's decision about the mask ban. So we see this as sort of like a steady erosion of freedom over time. But I don't think that Hong Kong is suddenly going to become Beijing overnight. So I think that we do still have some areas where we can preserve freedom. So, for example, in the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, it lays out several different areas for cooperation that the U.S. currently engages in with Hong Kong. That can be anywhere from trade to travel to engaging with Hong Kong's law enforcement and training, even training Hong Kong's judiciary. There may be some areas that we can pull back on early that will hold Beijing accountable without sacrificing the freedom of Hong Kongers. So I think we need to do our best to try to identify which areas we should pull back on as we pursue this decertification process and which ones should remain in place that the U.S. can try to help the Hong Kong people.
Olivia Enos is a senior policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. China has demanded that Washington stop oppressing Chinese companies after U.S. regulators declared telecom equipment suppliers Huawei and ZTE to be national security threats. The Federal Communications Commission blocked the Chinese vendors from receiving subsidies from a government fund, stepping up efforts to limit their access to the U.S. market. The foreign ministry accused Washington of abusing state power to hurt Chinese companies without any evidence. U.S. regulators say Huawei Technologies Limited, the biggest global maker of telecom switching equipment, and its smaller rival ZTE Corporation may facilitate Chinese spying. The companies deny the accusation. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases Director Dr. Anthony Fauci says he's worried as the coronavirus surges in parts of the United States. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has more.
It wasn't supposed to be like this after months of lockdowns and social distancing. 40,000 new virus cases are being reported each day.
We're going in the wrong direction.
Fauci says he wouldn't be surprised to hit 100,000 if things don't change, because outbreaks in parts of the nation put the entire nation at risk.
It could get very bad.
Fauci testified at a Senate hearing yesterday on reopening schools and colleges this fall.
I feel very strongly we need to do whatever we can to get the children back to school.
But says for that and other normal activities to resume, Americans must start following key recommendations on stopping the virus's spread. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Johns Hopkins University COVID-19 tracker counts around 10.5 million confirmed cases of the coronavirus worldwide. VOA has expanded coverage of the pandemic on our website, and that address, voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. International and regional powers agreed at talks on Tuesday to intensify a military campaign against Islamist militants in the West African Sahel region, with French President Emmanuel Macron saying victory over the jihadists was within grasp. Earlier today, I spoke with Paris-based journalist Catherine Field via WhatsApp to learn more.
The main focus of the summit was to plot future strategy. And really, that did seem to have been achieved. All the people around the table, the leaders, whether that was actually at the face-to-face summit or the later video summit, all of them came away determined that there does need to be an engagement on the ground in the G5 Sahel region, and particularly in that strategic three borders region, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. French President Emmanuel Macron came out of this summit very positive, saying that victory is possible and it is necessary to have stability in Africa and Europe. But other leaders were slightly more circumspect. When you look at the Mauritanian president, he hosted the summit. He came away being much more cautious. He said that there had been significant progress, but that it was insufficient in the face of the mounting challenges that the Sahel nations have to face. And in that respect, it's violent extremism in all its forms.
It sounds like the overall result was somewhat of a mixed bag. Can you kind of break down the actual action items that were decided at this G5 Sahel summit?
Just to keep up with what strategy that they have had in place since January. If you think back to earlier this year, there was that very strategic summit in southwestern France in Pau, when they decided with military strategists to change their offensive tactics in that Three Frontiers region. And that was where they got more military involved and they got more on-the-ground troops there. So, and of course, there was that strategic increase in French troops. So that was what they've agreed, that yes, this has got you to go some way yet. However, they are still saying that there's a long way to go. And the other point which came up again and again in the discussions is the risk that outside interference and outside influences on this region are still a real threat. And in particular, Libya. There's a risk of spillover from the unrest in Libya, causing it more disarray in the Sahel. So that was, again, an issue. The other point has been the success of drones in the operations on the ground. Not just drones that are there thanks to the American forces, but also armed drones that the French forces are now using. So they say those armed drones are changing how it is on the ground, but still, it really was a summit where everyone came away realizing this is just the start. There's a long road ahead.
Catherine Field is a journalist based in Paris, France. Speaking on Israel's army radio station, Cabinet Minister Ophir Akunis confirmed that the West Bank annexation process would not begin on Wednesday, saying that officials were still working out the final details with their American counterparts. Akunis said he expected the annexation to take place later in July. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had aimed to start the process by Wednesday. The delay comes as British Prime Minister Boris Johnson made an extraordinary appeal to Israel to call off the plan in a front-page newspaper op-ed. The developments cast further uncertainty over whether Israel will ultimately follow through on the annexation initiative, which has drawn fierce international condemnations from some of Israel's closest allies. The Philippines' top broadcaster, ABS-CBN Corporation, has been ordered to stop transmitting satellite and digital television just weeks after its free TV and radio operations were halted, adding to worries over press freedom. The 66-year-old broadcaster has been at odds with President Rodrigo Duterte since his campaign for election in 2016, and its main license was not renewed when it expired in May. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter Stanley Gahete via Skype in Quezon City, the Philippines, to find out more about this latest development.
In this cease and desist order, Elias was issued despite the first issued CDO, or cease and desist order. We still don't know if NTC really forgot to include some of the other channels, the channel 43, including its cable channels. That's why they issued another cease and desist order, different from the May 5 issue ones. On what happened about this, Steve, the other six channels from digital terrestrial DTT, digital terrestrial television, was also halted because they said that the main franchise from the channel 2 was already expired, so it cannot carry the digital channels anymore. That was according to the NTC issued. But ABS-CBN said that the carrier that was being used by ABS-CBN was from another company, which is Amcara. So they are using it as a block time. So they said that there is no issue for them to air and use other channels because that is another owner. But NTC said, regardless, the block time arrangement, they recognize block time arrangement, but still you cannot air unless you have the main congressional franchise approved.
You know, this order came down yesterday, June 30th. What's been the reaction among journalist groups and press freedom advocates?
Okay, so many organizations, Union of Journalists of the Philippines, reacted about this issuance of National Telecommunications Commission, because the question is that why it was not included and why is it now added to the first cease and desist order issued by NTC? Why they did not include? Well, the NTC said that the Solicitors General told them that it is okay to issue another. The Foreign Correspondents Association of the Philippines, or FOCAP, the foreign members, they issued a statement that they are saddened and disappointed about this.
ABS-CBN is taking legal action. What's the latest on that front?
ABS-CBN is now, last May 7, ABS-CBN submitted a temporary restraining order, TRO, a petition to Supreme Court. But still, Supreme Court is not making any decisions yet about the first TRO. So the ABS-CBN still don't have any move, don't have any petition to be submitted on this second cease and desist order issued by NTC, because they are still planning if for example, they will file another TRO or petition, will it change the content of the petition that they submitted already before to Supreme Court, or they will sustain or maintain their petition on its original version of TRO that they already submitted.
Stanley Gehete is a journalist from Quezon City, just outside of Manila in the Philippines. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the release of the U.S. State Department's 2019 International Religious Freedom Report, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo noted positive developments regarding religious liberty in a number of countries, including Uzbekistan, the Gambia, and the United Arab Emirates. But he said, there's also a great darkness over parts of the world where people of faith are persecuted or denied the right to worship. U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback, declared that one place where people are suffering greatly on account of their faith is China. In a recent interview, he said that Chinese leaders are doubling down on their war on faith.
It's against everybody. It's against the Muslim Uyghurs, it's the Tibetan Buddhists, it's the Falun Gong, it's the Christian House Church, it's everybody.
Ambassador Brownback deplored the fact that China is also now using and exporting sophisticated technical systems of control.
It's not just imprisoning people now. It's these virtual police states with lots of cameras and artificial intelligence systems and monitoring of people who go into mosques or churches. And so it's high-tech oppression that's starting to take root.
Another regime that stands out for its violations of religious freedom is Iran, said Ambassador Brownback. One example is the persecution of Christian convert Mary Fatemeh Mohammadi, who was reportedly first arrested and imprisoned in 2017 and has been repeatedly harassed by Iranian authorities since then. Ambassador Brownback said her case is not an isolated one.
It's not just Christians in Iran. You can be the wrong brand of Islam. You can be Baha'is, get really rough treatment in Iran. But the Christians, and particularly Christian converts from Islam, just get a heavy level of persecution. We condemn all of it. And we really believe that if the Iranian government was looking after their own people, they would stand by religious freedom and say, this is a personal choice.
Ambassador Brownback also deplored the recent shocking honor killing in Iran of 14-year-old Romina Oshravi at the hands of her father. He condemned such killings as abhorrent, offensive to human dignity, and inimical to any true idea of faith and family. Religious liberty is a foundational human right, said Ambassador Brownback. The United States will continue to fight for people of all faiths, everywhere, at all times.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.